education equality. It's a long way off.
Not only will she not access primary school, and it won't be till perhaps her great-granddaughter might be the first one in the family who actually achieved secondary school in 100 years' time.
Plus, teaching children to think by teaching them language. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Part of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for the elimination of gender inequality in all levels of education by 2015. That's not a goal that's going to be met. But representatives of Education International were in New York in late March to encourage the UN to continue to keep pushing. Susan Hopgood is both president of Education International and the federal secretary of the Australian Education Union. Huldis Holst is Deputy General Secretary of Education International. They were in New York last month to address the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. Hopgood leads off.
UNESCO produce a report annually called the Global Monitoring Report, GMR, which reports on how governments, how countries are progressing in achieving the goals, which are to be achieved by 2015. Specifically, we're talking about all children completing primary education, for example. What has happened here is that UNGAI, which is the United Nations Girls Education Initiative, has produced a report, which is, if you like, a gender report, looking at the Global Monitoring Report through a gender lens to see how we're progressing. While, we weren't surprised with what it tells us. It's very startling in what it tells us. And that is that, basically we know we're not going to achieve the goals by 2015, but very specifically in relation to girls, it is going to take decades if we continue along the path that we're following now. It will take decades before we can be sure that we achieve all girls completing at least primary school. And in fact, well into the next century, 100 years before we can be sure that all girls will complete secondary school. Which government is going to tell a young girl living in a rural area in poverty in some country that not only will she not access primary school, but her daughter is unlikely to either, and her granddaughter might go to primary school but probably won't complete it, and it won't be till perhaps her great-granddaughter, who might be the first one in the family who actually achieved secondary school in 100 years' time. We're on the path where generations of girls and young women are going to miss out on the opportunity for education. We know that education is essential for young people to be able to participate fully in their adult life. We are fighting against attitudes to girls actually having education. In many countries, where there's poverty and they have to make a choice about whether girls or boys, their daughters or sons go to school. The sons go to school. We know that girls are missing out because of child marriage, because of domestic responsibilities.
This is Huldis Holst. The report that Susan is talking about does give examples of comparing countries that are similar, like two African countries that are, same level of poverty and so on, but have chosen different approaches as to how to get girls into school specifically and all children generally, and how these different approaches have given different results. And in that way, you can try to smoke out what are political priorities and what are cultural or traditional reasons. But it's very difficult to identify what is cultural, what is not.
Right.
But they can prove that some approaches seem to have greater effect than others. And basically, as far as I remember the report, it's the countries that specifically target rural areas, that target poverty specifically and girls specifically. So that general approaches don't seem to work, but targeted approaches seem to work.
We probably assume that this is an issue for undeveloped countries, third world countries. Is that the case?
Well, I can give you a perfectly good example, actually, and it's the country I come from, Australia. you know, we're a wealthy country. Our children are in school. You know, a lot of most of them complete secondary school. They have access to tertiary education. We have gender equality in the sense that, you know, there's no difference between girls and boys going to school, etc. However, when you actually look at what is going on in Australia, Indigenous children actually don't have the same results as non-Indigenous children. They don't complete secondary school. Some of them, in fact, we believe, don't really have access to secondary school in their communities. Their health outcomes are different. Their literacy and numeracy results are different. They are shown to be, you know, 2 to 3 years behind their non-Indigenous cohort. And so that's an example of, in actual fact, where you can have, you know, so-called Western countries, OECD countries, wealthy countries that are actually not achieving the goals fully.
Clearly, we are not meeting this goal by any stretch of the imagination. Is there any way to put teeth into an effort to push forward?
It requires a political will. It requires the resources to be provided for education to ensure that we can meet those goals. So that's the first point. All countries should be, in fact, increasing their education budgets. I mean, we believe that, you know, along with UNESCO, actually, that the target should be, the minimum should be 6% of GDP on education, and that you know, at least 20% of the budget should be spent on education. But in actual fact, what's been happening over the last few years, 2 or 3 years, is that there has been a decrease in the amount of overseas development aid, probably since the global financial crisis, that's when it started. There has been a decrease, but also there's been a decrease in the proportion of overseas development aid that's actually gone to education. In other words, countries have been moving the development aid to other areas. So that's the first point. The second point is that we would say that the finance has to be targeted. And Helbus has just made this point, that what we know is that in those countries where they've specifically targeted additional resources to those who are missing out, whether it be girls, whether it be rural children, whether it be Indigenous children, whether it be children with disabilities, that when you target, you have programs which specifically target in addition to what you normally do, in addition to that, then you can overcome those disadvantages and actually, move closer to the goals. And thirdly, we would say that it's really important that governments that develop education plans, this is what, you know, countries are encouraged to do, that they develop education plans which, you know, include these targets and so on, but that those education plans are developed in partnership with the teacher unions. Teacher unions who are the voice of the teaching profession in the country. We believe that we should be heard and assist governments to develop those plans. You know, none of this is about just access to education. It's not about, you know, putting those children who don't go to school now into a room of, you know, 60 with 60 others, with a teacher who is not qualified and with no resources to assist. It's about providing quality education. And if we are going to provide quality education, then what we need, what we believe underpins quality education is, if you like, three pillars: quality teaching, quality tools, and quality environments.
As with so many global issues, it's almost daunting to try to figure out how to address this. You've got governments that are at war, you've got religion, you've got cultural issues. So how do you proceed? Is the answer to simply keep chipping away at the problem and hope to see some sort of progress?
Yeah, this is Huldis. I'm more optimistic than that, because if we look at the development, no, we're not reaching the 2015 goals, but there has been major progress all across the globe in all kinds of countries, rich and poor, all cultures. So I think it's more about pushing forward on the good experiences we have and make them multiply. Because there are progress in countries in Africa, in Asia, in the Arab world, that perhaps some perceive that it's more difficult for girls, but we do have the good examples. And we need them to multiply within their own culture, their own region, so that they see that this is beneficial to all. There are good advocates for it. So I believe that it's possible. A lot of it is about will, although it's about financing too, but there's an awful lot that can be done if you just open up with a little bit of financing. And we see, like in parts of the Arab world, that they now have parity in access to education for girls, also in higher education. And then there's the next challenge of making it possible for them to enter the workforce. A lot of this is about what Susan said, making environments that are women-friendly, girl-friendly, so that you feel secure that your daughter or your wife is going to be safe. So it's about asking where are the obstacles and addressing the obstacles.
Susan Hopgood is both president of Education International and the federal secretary of the Australian Education Union. Huldis Holst is deputy general secretary of Education International. Coming up, where American education is falling behind. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1290. Oregon students will soon face tougher than ever standardized tests on their way to a lofty goal that every student will complete high school starting with the class of 2025. The new tests ask students to think critically and write out explanations. Those skills require a foundation for young students, beginning with language. Rob Manning looks at the connections between language and long-term academic success for all students.
We're going to talk about language in a minute, but first you have to meet Jackie Kahn. He has a whiteboard set up in his grandmother's living room. He's doing serious multiplication while his sisters chatter behind him. He's in first grade.
36 times 12.
What's the answer?
It's 432.
If you can't do that quite as quickly, Jackie got it right. Jackie has been learning math from his dad, Jung Chow Kong. He speaks through a Cantonese interpreter.
Yeah, this is Jackie's double-digit multiplication. This is pretty basic stuff for students in China, but of course not the same for, American students.
Instruction is changing in Oregon. Backers of the National Common Core Standards say they're meant to help Americans compete internationally. The standards aim to go deeper with a focus on analysis, context, and applying skills like multiplication. Shannon McCaw trains teachers on the Common Core Standards. At a recent conference, she quizzed elementary teachers with sample questions about budgets and restaurant menus.
You read, write, and do math not separately, but oftentimes together. And it's very rare that in life you'll ever be handed a worksheet and say, crank out all these math problems. It's solve this math problem in an applied setting where you have to read and gather information and write about, create some kind of proposal or, something like that.
A recent paper out of Stanford University makes the case that in the Common Core, quote, language permeates all the standards in many ways, even in those cases where the word language is not explicitly mentioned. Language has long been a focus for teaching students who don't use English at home. But language specialist Maria Poppy says there's also an issue for the 75% of students at Earl Boyles Elementary who live in poverty. She reads.
By age 3, middle-class children had working vocabularies roughly twice the size of poor children's. By age 3.
So there's a language gap that happens by age 3.
Right. So those students come in already behind in kindergarten. It's pretty sad. It breaks my heart to even think that.
Language and reading are connected, and with third grade reading a critical milestone, schools often intervene with struggling readers. First grader Dude Rabideau goes to reading club with specialist Katrina Shavita. She uses rapid-fire drills on letter sounds and short words. They keep Dude on his toes.
Top to bottom, bottom to top, Dude. Get ready.
In.
Get ready.
Walk.
Get ready.
It.
Get ready.
It.
Get ready.
Walk.
Get ready.
In.
Awesome job. Way to work it, dude.
Way to work it, dude.
Awesome job.
The reading interventions help struggling readers learn words. Taking those words and putting them together in complete sentences is a school-wide priority at Earl Boyles for Principal Erica Ganay. She says with the recent changes in language instruction, students are using more academic language. How does Ganay measure that? By talking to students.
I say, oh, good morning, you know, good morning, so-and-so, how are you today? I get a complete sentence back. I don't get a grunt.
Anais Herrera-Martinez is a first grader at Earl Boyles. Her family speaks English and lives close to school. She recently showed me around her yard, pointing out a broken bicycle and a beehive.
These things people, and they're hurt really bad, and they make poison, but they get honey from flowers, and we have flowers in our garden.
Anais is in the language class for students in greatest need. On this day, she and her classmates get cards with pictures on them, and they have to describe what's happening. Anais is looking at popcorn.
He will pour the little seeds in the popcorn machine.
Then?
Then the popcorn pops. Then last, she and her dad eat together.
The cards help students use complete sentences, but that first, then, last construction is also an early lesson in how to organize thoughts. Some aspects of the new Common Core curriculum and language approach have some teachers and parents nervous. Anais's mom, Josette Herrera, is among them.
What they're learning now is like, I think they're teaching them way too much, or too soon.
Too much too soon? Her daughter's language teacher, Karen McDonald, acknowledges that it's sometimes a struggle for young students. For instance, explaining answers isn't automatic.
At first they were saying it was just in my brain, I just got the answer in my brain, but now they're starting to explain how they got the answer and what picture helped them get the answer.
Mom Josette Herrera says she didn't complain about the demands of first grade because she thinks kids are capable of a lot.
I mean, I understand kids are sponges, and then, I mean, they pick up a lot of stuff, but I think they could have waited.
Karen McDonald says there's no need to wait.
I think they are capable of it. I really do.
Back at Jackie Kong's whiteboard, the 7-year-old's a little unsure how to explain how he solved his multiplication problem. He'd rather run upstairs to play. Jung Chow Kong says putting math into context, as the Common Core will require, is a little beyond his son right now. But he says not for Jackie's older sister.
He hasn't got to that point yet, but Lisa has, obviously. Well, for example, when they go grocery shopping, you know, dad will ask, hey, you know, how much we're buying, how much money I'm giving, and then what's the change? She knows how to do that. He hasn't been taught that yet.
Jackie's sister Lisa is 10, so she'll be taking the Common Core tests when they start a year from now. Jackie Kong and the rest of the class of 2025 will take them a year later when they're third graders. Rob Manning, OPB News.
Rob Manning's Class of 2025 reports are part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public broadcasting initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So far, we've talked about education equity as a worldwide goal and a program to help American children do better in school. But once those children are in the workforce, the gender inequity issue doesn't go away. Gender Justice is a nonprofit organization that eliminates gender barriers through education programs, public policy advocacy, and litigation. KFAI producer Dixie Treichel has more.
Two lawyers, Lisa Stratton and Jill Galding, founded the nonprofit organization Gender Justice in 2010. They work to eliminate gender barriers and educate about cognitive bias, the subtle ways that stereotypes affect our perceptions and preferences that lead to discrimination.
I'm Lisa Stratton. We quickly realized that we shared this passion for this intersection of law and psychology and cognitive science. There's a lot of groundbreaking work identifying how that science impacts the law, what it means for the way that we challenge discrimination under the law.
I'm Jill Galding. Ultimately, what I'm interested in doing is to take what we understand more and more about how discrimination works in your brain at that almost neuron level, and take that knowledge into places where discrimination happens and really limits people's equal opportunity, and figure out, you know, what we can do about it. How should the law counteract discrimination? How can all of us in our everyday lives counteract discrimination?
I represented the first female crane operator at Bland & Paper in several years of litigation because the men did not want her there, and they said that, and there was testimony. We don't want you here. We don't want women doing this job. So that still happens. At the same time, these less conscious, less intentional, but equally effective processes in our brain, they reach the same result. We're just not as aware of them. So part of our mission as gender justice is to make those less obvious types of discrimination more evident, to show the process by which they work and the effect, the real world effect they have on people's lives.
It's really important to us that we chose the name gender justice. We thought a lot about what name would work, and gender is really what we're about in the broadest sense of that term. You know, we can't dismantle patriarchy unless we think about the little slots that it puts both men and women into, and we have to fight back on both of those fronts with an understanding of the different challenges men and women face in that situation. And I would add to that, of course, LGBT issues, absolutely inextricable from the problems that we have in thinking about sexual orientation, sexual identity, gender role. All of those things are tied together in the set of expectations that we have. And so if we want to dismantle those expectations and give people more opportunity, we have to be willing to fight back against gender barriers wherever we find them. So we represent men and women. We represent people who, for instance, faced pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. We would represent a man who was discriminated against because he was taking on a parenting role that wasn't coinciding with people's notion of what a man and a father's job is. We represent people who are discriminated against because they're gay or because they're transgender and they're not getting access to the health care that they need. The whole spectrum of gender barriers is what we're interested in dismantling.
Gender Justice addresses the intersection of race, class, and gender bias, along with hosting and sponsoring educational events, such as the showing of films like Misrepresentation and The Invisible War.
We are often asked to get involved in coalitions. We do that a lot. For example, there was a group of female legislators who gathered some of the leaders of groups that work on gender issues together and strategize with the nonprofit leaders as to how they could reach the public on some of the important issues in the last budget debate. We have spoken at rallies and, you know, different kinds of public events, but we've also provided a vehicle in Minnesota to expose audiences here to some of these great documentary films like Misrepresentation. We hosted that, sponsored it, had it brought into Minnesota.
And what people like Lisa and I have tried to do is go back and say, what's the bottom line? Let's just think clearly about this. What do we really care about? And what we really care about is, should it matter if you're a Muslim or you're a woman or you're over 50 in the workplace? Should that affect how much you're paid or whether you have a chance to advance? Obviously, the answer is no. That's what the law is trying to get at. And so if you can prove, however you would prove it, that that factor made a difference and it shouldn't have, then you've proven discrimination.
Gender justice works to create a society where people can reach their full potential and not be held back by implicit bias, stereotypes, or prejudice. To find out more about their services, go to www.genderjustice.us. This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI. 10,000 Fresh Voices on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% Archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.